All right, it looks like they've shut the doors, so I'll get started. All right, thank you. The select few who have braved the 4:45 session, the afternoon after the night before. I appreciate that you've all made it here. I'm Sarah Manning Dawson. For those of you who heard Kamal Janardhan's session, she spoke of compliance in Office and Office 365. She is my manager. She owns many of the compliance features within the Office product. And the program management team that I lead deals with e-discovery and with auditing. And they are a very important partnership in investigations and improving compliance. And I'll talk a little bit about that in this presentation. But to start with, given that it's 4:45, sorry, I'm a little short for this podium and can't see beyond this TV. Given it's 4:45, I'm sure you are all asking yourselves, am I in the right session? So I thought I would give you a criteria to decide whether or not it is worth your late afternoon on a fine Tuesday in Austin to be here. And I promise you that if the criteria matches the fact that you are in the right session, I will deliver. And at the end of this session, we will review and see if you learned a thing or two, which is my goal. So you may not need to be here. You may be free to go if any of the following are true of your organization. So before I start, I should mention this auditing is not security auditing. Sid M. delivered a session yesterday that spoke a lot about perimeter security. The auditing we're talking about is compliance auditing and investigative auditing for internal users. So once they're within the perimeter wall, we can help with security scenarios. But in general, this is about compliance and internal auditing, making sure my users within my org are doing the right thing. And so, reasons you might not need to be here. Number one, you are a member of a perfect organization. You know, like family, right? Like kids, they know what to do and they always do it exactly. Number two, the country I live in is lawless, as is the state, province, county, or municipality. If this is you, auditing probably is not an interesting feature within Office. Another reason you might not need auditing is if you have an organization that does no communication. I promise you, you won't be accountable for communication within your organization if there isn't any. But by definition of the word organization, this is probably unlikely. And finally, auditing probably doesn't apply to you if you work in cash only, in unmarked bills, and nobody saw you here. In fact, auditing will probably be a great disservice to your organization if this sounds like you. So for the rest of us that are in organizations where the org is trying to do the right thing and is also composed of a bunch of human beings, mostly who want to do the right thing, sometimes not, because we're emotional creatures and sometimes we just don't know and sometimes behaviors are hard to explain, this gives me job security and you a reason to be at this session. So I'll sort of divide this talk into four different areas. We've never done an auditing presentation at MEC before. And we did do sort of a partial one at the SharePoint conference, but it was really small. It was like two slides within it. And we've made an enormous investment in the auditing space in Office and Office 365 starting last year. And that went along with Jeff Teper, our VP's commitment to making compliance a first-class citizen. And so what he did was he took the compliance teams out of SharePoint. He took the compliance teams out of Exchange. He took everywhere else that had thought about doing any kind of compliance, and he put them under one set of directors. And we're led by Christian Andeker. And for those of you who have been to MEC before, Christian used to be OWA. He was Mr. OWA for a long time. And he grew OWA into an absolute first-class web email product. So he now leads. He's the director of our compliance org. And within it, we do anti-spam, antivirus, as well as DLP, auditing, e-discovery, archive, retention, preservation, and encryption. So we are the compliance team, and there's been a heavy investment in making it easy to use and seamless across all of the Office 365 workloads, and eventually across Windows file servers and every other Microsoft content generator that's out there. So I'll talk about why does being in the know matter. This is just general scenarios where auditing will really help save your company risk and save your organization money. How can we, the Microsoft organization, help you? And this is more generic than just the auditing solutions, but it's how they all fit together. And also what our cloud does to help you be compliant within your orgs. Then I'll get more specific about today's auditing solutions, and we'll talk about our future vision for what we're building to make it easier. How many of you did not attend Quentin or Kamal's session? Okay, so a few of you were at neither of those, so it's a bit of a treat for me to introduce to you something we're just in the process of building, which is our Unified Compliance Console. That'll be in the what we're building to make it easier section, and we'll just show you our sort of a work in progress that we're planning to deliver this year and next, basically in the coming months, to give you one place to configure compliance, to report on it, to set up your controls, and that's across all of our Office workloads. All right, so why does it matter? Why do we need an audit record? Why do we need a history of what users are doing with my content? Why do I need to know this was edited at 12:15 on September 14th last year by this user? Why do I know who changed these permissions, or why do I need to know who changed these permissions when? Why do I need to know who added this user to this Active Directory security group or distribution group? Well, the way that I think about auditing and the way that we frame it in our user experience, there's kind of three scenario buckets that are interesting. These are not mutually exclusive. There's some overlap, but I think in terms of a model for what you need to do in your organization, this is the way I think of it. So auditing in general helps you determine that your organization is doing the right thing with information and technology. So short of those of you in orgs with perfect human beings, which by definition doesn't exist, this is what needs to happen in order for you to be compliant. So I think of three scenario buckets. The first one, this is the Wild West of the scenario buckets because subpoenas are all over the map. Anybody can sue anybody for anything. So help me respond to this lawsuit. Beyond e-discovery, which just digs into what content is out there, give me a history of what happened to this content. Who viewed it? Who edited it? Who deleted it? Where'd it go? 90% of U.S. corporations are currently engaged in litigation. Only 1 in 10 is free of this very costly issue. Average number of active lawsuits for large companies, about 150. And $1 million average per case cost to find and call the evidence. So when I say find and call, I'm not just talking about legal discovery of content, which our e-discovery tool covers. I'm talking about looking at audit logs and other logs to get a big picture of what happened. Maybe you look at who ran their card key to get into what door when. It's sort of the bigger picture, very costly. I'm very happy to be joined by some of the Microsoft LCA team, both the ones that do e-discovery and the ones that have a net to throw over me if I start talking about government surveillance too much. I'm just kidding. They're actually going to help out with the talk a little bit when we get to that part. But they know how expensive this can be. They understand our legal budget. And so our goal, I mean, people sue. We're not going to stop that. But we want to make it as easy, as efficient, and as inexpensive for you as possible to produce the evidence that you need. All right, number two, regulations and law. This is a pretty big bucket. I'm regulated. Help me know and help me show that we are doing the right thing. And, you know, to know that is also to know when you're not. So we did a survey. It was a fairly small survey, but what was really interesting is 3/4 of the respondents said that they were regulated. Now, of course, this is a spectrum, right? We're all regulated to some extent. We all have to abide by PII laws, for example. But there are some much more heavily regulated industries that are pretty well understood to be heavily regulated: finance, insurance, healthcare, and schools, for example, dealing with younger children. So that was interesting to us, and I also reflected the laws, regulations, and policies that they cited in the font size here. Of course, PII is a very common one because it's a law that applies to everyone. But we got a lot of HIPAA, a lot of credit card exchange laws applied, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and the usual suspects, depending on the industry, SOX compliance, the SEC, and the all well understood 17A-4. Also, a number of other regulations we're probably familiar with, the FDA, the FAA, any kind of financing or financial protection in other countries came up as well. So the UK FSA is an example of that. But many different regulations. And the third one, help me enforce internal policies. Again, these can be all over the map, but there's a few that are pretty consistent across organizations: standards of business conduct, confidentiality, financial integrity, anti-corruption, etc. So these are where risk is created and where having the necessary records can really help you respond to that. And the easier we make it to record and find these records, the easier it will be for you not to spend half of your profits on responding to litigation. So the second of two slides in this section, which is why being in the know matters, is a pop quiz. So how many of you consider yourself working with or for heavily regulated industries? All right, I'd say just under half. So at the end of this slide, I'm hoping that we are much more in the know about what's out there that you may or may not have to adhere to. So here's what's going to happen is I'm going to show you line by line the first three cells in the line item, and I'll read out the in a nutshell. It's basically summarizing the law or regulation or policy that this line item is referring to, and the first person to raise their hand and name what regulation I'm referring to gets a prize. And because it's auditing, the prize is what you will save if you help to manage the risk of your company. It's money. But it is not legal tender in Texas or any other state, but it tastes very good. So Ali, where did Ali go? Ali over here is the product manager for compliance, and he is going to help out. So Ali, the first person whose hand is up in the air, please just acknowledge them and let me know which regulation, law, or policy we are talking about. All right, you guys ready? Okay. Don't play games with your financial reporting. This applies to all publicly traded companies. All right, who's first? Ali, would you mind coming up here just so people know you're there? So, what specific law? Do you know the specific law that said, okay, CXOs can't hide from their financial statements and your best friend can't be your financial auditor? It's a specific law that was adopted by the SEC. The SEC translated it into 10 different rules. Okay, who was next? You are correct, sir. That is the Sarbanes-Oxley Law of 2002. And the place that auditing can help with this is in a couple of different sections of this law. In 404, there is a lot of information about disclosing and assessing internal controls. There's also a section about disclosing off-balance sheet items. So it matters where that information is stored, it matters who touches it, and it matters that you're able to prove who has and hasn't accessed it, edited it, copied it, deleted it, or moved it. Just a call out is that some of the larger companies, ones with about $5 billion in revenue, the average costs of this were $1.7 million. Now that appears like a measly 0.04% of revenue, but consider these some low-margin companies, right? Maybe they have a 0.5% profit margin. That's 7% of their profit. So that's a pretty big deal. So making this cheaper to adhere to is our goal. All right, number two. Don't disclose enough info to be able to identify a person. This is actually a series of laws. So you can either give me one of the laws or the concept. This is not HIPAA. It's a little bit more general. If you can figure out who the person is with the information disclosed, even if it's vague, it was too much information. That's PII. That's correct. So PII is actually a series of laws. Many countries have PII laws. There's a couple of examples here. There was the Privacy Act of 1974, which defined PII, or which spoke of PII. California had an act in 2003, many different countries. This one I specifically called out because it speaks to how these laws are not always specific enough for us to be able to implement the controls at the software level. A lot of these are open to interpretation, and a lot of these are very contextual. I'll give you an example. A police officer is reporting the latest stuff to the blotter in the media, and the chief has said, do not disclose any PII for these perpetrators. That's not allowed. And so he's in a city of about 1 million, and he's reporting to the paper, and he says, you know, someone stole a car yesterday, and that person was female. So is female, in this context, PII? Correct. It is not. There's probably 500,000 females in the city. There's a school down the street called Contoso Elementary. And Contoso Elementary has 6 teachers, 5 of which are male and 1 is female. So then the policeman adds that the perpetrator was female and worked at Contoso Elementary. Right, those two together form PII. Those two facts put together uniquely identify a person. They become PII. So it's very contextual, some of these laws. And like I said, can't always be enforced at a software level because of that context. And just to call out that green box, states have even ruled that zip codes fall into this category. So again, really depends on the context. All right, number three. Be careful what you do, website, with stuff typed in by children under 13. So websites which are targeted or could possibly target to children under 13 have to post a privacy policy, protect the information and get rid of it as soon as it no longer applies. A lot of stringent controls.
Is it COPPA?
It is COPPA. Well done. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Not to be confused with CIPA, which applies to schools, K-12 schools and libraries, putting filters in place to protect people and children against harmful content. All right. And interestingly enough, this one's enforced by the FTC. So the Supreme Court actually ruled that nonprofits are a part of this as well. So it's not just for commercial use. 4, don't share someone's health info. Someone, who was it that already?
Okay.
Red Hat. This is HIPAA, yes. So this one's everywhere. I was at Office Max the other day at the customer service desk, and they had a notice saying, don't give us your health information. I imagine someone disclosed too much, and then that made them on the line for giving them a privacy policy and, you know, making sure it was protected. So HIPAA is everywhere because health information is kind of a generic bucket. Interesting one about HIPAA is the fines actually vary by intent. I mean, that's often the case, but HIPAA is very specific about you know, whether or not it was reasonable or whether you were just completely ignorant, and it's kind of a sliding scale. Willful neglect, if you correct it within 30 days, is a lot less painful than willful neglect. So just interesting because it speaks to them paying attention to the intent. Again, the human factor. All right, and finally, the company you work for says, don't give away our valuable intellectual property. Don't give away our product code. All docs for this new awesome device should only be stored here because it's our data. What does this sound like to you?
Non-disclosure,
you know, that's close enough. It's an employer confidentiality agreement, which is very common when you're hired on with an organization today. All right. So now that we understand some of the spaces in which auditing can be important, can save you money, can help you to manage risk, how can Microsoft as a, you know, as a product line and as a service offering help you? Well, let's get into where auditing fits into the big picture specifically. So Kamal, in her talk, spoke of the many different things we have in our compliance suite. And one way to think about it is that, especially with regulations, laws, and internal policies, you know what's supposed to happen. You know, subpoenas are a bit more Wild West sometimes, but for the things that are well-defined or even loosely defined, you know what should happen, and you can put some controls in place. You know, we don't always know what the legislator meant by it has to be in hot storage for 2 years, fully encrypted, and then it can be in colder storage. We don't always know, but as these laws age, right, we get more and more case law which defines clearer and clearer boundaries about what you can and can't do with these. So you put controls in place, and we have archive and hold, or archive and preservation, which lets you keep what you need. We have deletion policies, which is the artist formerly known as retention policies, which help you get rid of what you need to get rid of because it can be a liability if it's sticking around. We have DLP and encryption, so you can set up data loss prevention rules, transport rules, or decide to react to sensitive content being found by encrypting it or taking other actions. So these controls are in place. You've secured your organization as tightly as you can, but you still are an organization of human beings, some of them not knowing the right things to do, some of them, you know, angry and they didn't get the raise they wanted and can be malicious. Either way, the controls, you know, can't guarantee anything. So sort of the second bucket of features, the way I think about showing compliance or investigating a user if it seems like something's out of whack, is through our e-discovery tools together with auditing. So e-discovery allows you to search for important content. And Quentin spoke, he did a session on e-discovery, so I'll just show a couple of screenshots in this one. But this allows you to search for important content and then audit history, so the records of activity on that content will let you show that people did the right thing, or when they didn't, that they didn't, and who it was. All right, so I'm gonna go down to the orange square at the bottom. Just to reiterate what I talked about at the beginning, this is not about auditing security attacks, security breach attacks from outside. We do not deal with auth logs at all. And the reason is because that's an enormous area. Several teams at Microsoft are you know, dedicated to solving that around, you know, Active Directory and perimeter security. And our antivirus, anti-spam teams, we're really about once the user has authenticated, what have they done? So we can partner with a security investigation because we can describe the set of activity a user has performed, and if it was a breach, then you'll know what the breach did. But our first and foremost scenarios that we're building our user experiences for is the is internal compliance, so policies and regulatory compliance. We see the set of users or the set of usage that you might be interested in as falling loosely into four buckets. First of all, you want to know what your users are doing. You want to know that they're doing the right thing, that, you know, only FTEs are looking at confidential data, that, you know, that they're The people who are viewing HBI docs or docs about reviews are the people that should be. And then we've got compliance officers. So they have elevated access to some things. You know, they usually have a lot less of an elevated surface area than, say, your IT admin. But, I mean, a compliance officer often can search across your entire corpus of data and export it. That's a pretty powerful set of permissions. So keeping track of what your compliance officers are doing, your IT admins are doing, and in Office 365, the DC operators are doing are sort of the four categories of things that we look at. Now, DC operators is specific to the cloud, and I'll talk about this a little bit more on a different slide, but we've been very, very intentional about being completely transparent about any commandlets that are run that would impact your tenant in any way run by DC ops. So what happens is you'll call support, you'll need to increase the size of an archive mailbox for whatever reason, and support will escalate that to the engineering team. There is a very stringent approval process that we go through before we ever run a commandlet. It's called lockbox. So we ask for elevation from director levels or principal level people in the org. They look at the level of access that you're asking for. They'll grant it. It expires after an hour. So very rigorous process. Sometimes they'll even talk to the customer to figure out why it's something that needs to be done. And then if it really needs to be done, the commandlet will be run, and you will have a record in your tenant, and this is in the cloud, of course, in your tenant you'll have a record of anything that DC Ops touched that had anything to do with your tenant. So we filter out stuff like load balancing across mailboxes, because that's totally just hardware and has, you know, it applies to many, many tenants. But anything specific to your tenant you'll know about. All right, and on that note, this is really specific to the cloud. So just a show of hands, how many of you have either test mailboxes or live production mailboxes in the cloud today? All right, excellent, about half of you. All right, I wanted to make sure this was applicable because, of course, there's a lot of nervousness right around privacy and security in the cloud. And so our audit story, while it's mostly focused on internal compliance, we've also sort of picked up the effort around making sure whatever you need to know about what's going on with your data is visible to you. So there's three facets to this, and the third one I'm actually going to invite our LCA representative up to speak a little bit more about it, because it says government snooping, which is kind of a daring concept to even state on a slide. So I'll talk about the first one, supporting customer compliance. We've done a lot of work to make sure we've done our part such that the customer can say, I'm compliant in Regulation X. So for example, we establish where customers needed a HIPAA business associate agreement such that they are able to make a claim that they are HIPAA compliant with their data in our data center. Same with FSMA. We've been granted the authority to operate from a federal agency such that organizations and agencies that need to be FSMA compliant can host their data in our cloud and claim FSMA compliancy. True of FERPA, the EU model clause. CGIS was something that Jeff mentioned in the keynote. What this means is we have done what needs to be done in order for customers that live in our data center to be able to meet CGIS Security Policy 5.2 requirements. So I've actually given a website on that top right, in that pink box on the top right, and that has a lot of information about how this works and, you know, exactly what has to happen for these regulations to be met by tenants. But we've made leaps and bounds in all these areas. As far as accreditations, these are sort of our compliance areas. We're ISO 27001 compliant, first major business productivity public cloud to have implemented this, and the SAS 70 Type 1 and Type 2. I won't go too deep into transparency and government snooping. Just I'll touch on the philosophy quickly. And it's really about us As a cloud service, we do not own your data. We do not own your data. I think our tenants understand that. I think we understand that. We're just working on the government. We do not own your data. We don't want to look at your data. We don't want to sell your data. We don't want to mine your data to decide if we need to sell you Under Armour socks in the corner of your browser, right? We don't want to touch your data. We want to be proud hosts of your data. We want to be stewards of your data, but we don't own your data. And so we're doing a lot of things on a lot of different levels to advocate that we are simply stewards of the data, and we're giving you tools to be productive but don't own the data. A couple of things we're doing internally are the DC ops auditing that I've talked about. We also are very, very transparent about government requests for data, law enforcement request reports, and we've been working hard into advocacy. We're actually on a consortium together with Google and Apple and Facebook and strangest bedfellows ever together. But of course, that's what politics does. And I'll invite Catherine up to talk a little bit more for a couple minutes about the advocacy work that we're doing.
Thanks, Sarah. Is this on? Can you all hear me? Hi, I'm Catherine Romero, and I am in Microsoft Legal, and I mainly support Exchange. I also have a bunch of my colleagues here who are in eDiscovery, and I'll call out Ying Chi, who supports Sarah's organization, Information Protection and Christian. And if any of you were in the security session that Sid and Raji had yesterday, you would have heard them say, but it bears worth repeating, that we don't build backdoors to our products. We don't provide encryption keys to the government. We don't help them break encryption. We don't give them unfettered access to our service. And in fact, we're extremely committed to protecting the privacy of our customers' data as stewards of the data. And a lot of what Ying and I do in the legal department revolves around that, revolves around making sure we are keeping everything secure and private. I see Sarah has got the slide up there, which is great. It's got some of the sites that you can check out. And the quote, "We're committed to notifying businesses and government customers if we receive legal orders related to their data." That is true. Our process is if we do receive something with a gag order, we will tell the government, you need to go directly to the customer, and we will push on that very hard. But we've also publicly committed to challenging that in court if we can't get them to do that. On a larger level, as Sarah mentioned, we are leading a cross-industry group that's calling for reform of government surveillance with a bunch of interesting bedfellows, and we've adopted 5 principles that we would like governments to adopt, and we've endorsed those principles with these other companies. The first one being transparency. We want to be transparent about the number and nature of government requests that we receive. We have actually brought litigation against the U.S. government and have had permission, and I think you've got that website up there, to post some information about the requests that we receive from national security authorities, and we continue to push on that. We also think that governments should be transparent about the requests that they're putting out there and that they should post that. Second principle is oversight and accountability. We want to make sure that there's a clear legal framework under which governments are compelling service providers to provide information. We want checks and balances part of the process. We want to have independent courts and an adversarial process. And we also want to publicly disclose the rulings of those decisions. We also want to avoid conflicts among governments. There is a huge disparity in the different privacy laws around the world. Some are much more restrictive than others. And so we want to develop a framework under which we can provide data across jurisdictions and request data. Also want governments to respect the free flow of information. We don't want governments saying that you can't access lawfully available information because it's across borders. We also don't want governments telling service providers, oh, you have to operate locally or you have to build infrastructure within our boundaries. And then finally, we really want to limit the government's authority to collect user information. We want to codify limitations on their ability to compel service providers to provide user data. And we also don't want governments to be in the business of bulk collection of internet data. And I think you've got the reform. If you go to the reformgovernmentsurveillance.com, that's the consortium page where you can see the letter that we've all signed on to the U.S. government. We think that we need to be the leaders in this area and on these principles. So thanks, and I'll be around if you have questions or want to talk further.
Thanks a lot, Catherine. All right, so we've talked a lot about the theory, a lot about the auditing space. Let me talk a little bit or start to dive into what our products offer in order to help you to be compliant and in order to help you audit. So this is a DLP example. The DLP team has created templates which help you recognize patterns, string matches, for certain text strings or certain numbers that probably or are likely to be a match to some of the things that are protected under these regulations. So it's a tool in the toolkit to be able to put the proper controls in place in order to be compliant as part of the DLP story that we deliver in exchange. And the DLP Unplugged session is probably a great place to go if you want to learn more. If you want to learn more about these sensitive data types. All right. One other place that, as a whole, our compliance solution can help with is the in-place advantage. So this is our general philosophy on the compliance team about having all the tools that you need in the same place as the data. So we want to avoid you having to take all of the content that you feel you need to operate on for compliance, move it out, have to pay for that storage solution, have to pay for moving it and all of the failure and redundancy involved in moving it. And then because it's in a different place, you're out of context of where that information started, and you may have to install add-ons for users, more complex experience, and just far more expensive. So our philosophy is really about lowering the costs, giving you a single experience, and making it easier to manage by having everything within your Office solution. So having our compliance tools within SharePoint, operating directly on the content, having these compliance tools within Exchange, and we'll get into the Exchange auditing next, but having them operate, having them live within the user experiences whenever there are end user experiences. We feel it's a huge cost benefit to do this with all of our compliance tools. All right, so two more sections. The first is what we have today. So what we offer in our product today. And then I'll talk about our future vision. So today we have a number of auditing features already present in the product. Who here has never used Exchange auditing? Okay, so most of you are familiar with what we offer today in Exchange. So we offer mailbox activity auditing, so a number of different things that you can enable in Exchange. We also offer admin activity auditing. So all commandlet activity can be tracked and recorded, and of course in our cloud DC admin operations are a separate log, a separate report that you can look at. So right now there's a default retention period for these logs. All of the admin logs go into a single system mailbox where they are stored. User mailboxes are stored locally in that user's mailbox. And we also do delegate mailbox activity reporting and auditing. And in Office 365, that's the only type of mailbox auditing we do. We made a cost-benefit decision that it's far more interesting to know when other people are accessing your data and not what you're doing within your own mailbox. Because many, many customers told us that once it's in your mailbox, of course you view it. It ends up on your ActiveSync phone, and I can't really tell what you've done with it. I would be very interested to talk to anyone here who has critical needs around owner mailbox auditing in our service. Because while we realize that the decision was a cost-benefit one, of course there's something of a benefit to it. It's always better to have more information than none. But the scale of trying to audit everything everyone does in their own mailbox was what drove the cost-benefit decision. So I would like to hear your scenarios. Today in Office 365, we have delegate only. That will likely change in the future. We're looking at having logins as part of the security scenario, but that's only as we extend ourselves to become a compliance and security auditing platform. Right now, we're focused on compliance. So in SharePoint, we've got a bunch of site collection activity that we audit, create, delete group, add, remove members, permissions changes, and then the usual suspects for item activity, so edit, view, move, delete, copy, everything that users would typically do on a document. In Office 365, we do not yet include view auditing. That's purely a scale issue that we're working to get figured out. So you can see the UI in each of these, but let's do a little walkthrough of what we have in Exchange today. All right, so I think what I'll do is I'll start with PowerShell, because we know compliance officers and lawyers and HR love PowerShell. Right now, we do not have a user interface to configure mailbox auditing. That will change with our unified compliance console. So I'll just use PowerShell for the time being to show you what I've configured here. So I'll get mailbox permissions on Astrid. Oh, I waited too long. I'm going to involve two users. I'm going to involve Sarah Mann, which is me, and Astrid. And I am a delegate on Astrid's mailbox. So I'm just showing you here that I've set up full access to Astrid's mailbox. I ran the get mailbox permission command on Astrid's mailbox. You see Sarah Mann has full access to her mailbox. I will also show you that on my mailbox, I've got auditing configured. So you can run a PowerShell script and configure auditing, or of course do it in bulk. But I've got a number of different activities configured on my mailbox. I'm tracking delegate activity and admin activity for a number of different actions. And I will also show you that that is true of Astrid's as well. Here she's configured with admin and delegate activity as well. So knowing that, here I am in my mailbox, and because I'm an admin, I'm in the admin center. So let me first show you, if I go to compliance management in the Exchange admin console, there's an auditing section, and if I click on it, there's a number of different reports that I can run. So I can run a non-owner access report, administrator role group, e-discovery and hold report, litigation report. I can export the logs. I can view the admin log, so I can see all the commandlets that any administrators have run in my org, export it, and here, because it's an Office 365 tenant, I'm able to see what data center admins have done, if anything. So let's just have a look at the non-owner mailbox access report. And what I'll do is I'll just look at Astrid's mailbox. And I'll look at all non-owner access. And I'll search. Now, here's a record. The last record in here is May 31st. So yesterday, I opened her folder top secret. So I was peeking at her mailbox. So let's get out of there, and I'm going to go to Outlook, and I'm going to go back into Astrid's mailbox. So I'm going to open another mailbox, because as I showed you, I'm a delegate on her mailbox. I have full access permissions. And And I think I'm going to take, here, there's a mailbox audit log search. I'm going to take it and I'm going to move it into her low prio folder because I just don't think it's interesting. And she's going to be missing it, and she's going to call help desk, or she's going to call a compliance officer, and they will be able, in this case, I have the privileges. Actually, let me log out of her account. Oops. Anyone with the permissions can go back to the EAC. Compliance management, auditing, and try to figure out who's been moving stuff out of Astrid's mailbox. So, I'm just looking at the last 2 weeks, have chosen Astrid's mailbox, looking at all non-owner access, and I'm going to search. And now I see that at 3:29 p.m., so it's in my PST, which is my mailbox time, I opened the recipient cache here. I opened her inbox, and I opened the folder top secret. So there I've got a record of some of the activity that's in Astrid's mailbox. Yeah, it should. I wonder if it's... Here, let me... There it is. Thank you. So there, it shows that I moved this message with that big ugly GUID in the title from her inbox into the destination low prio, and that it succeeded. So that's an example of being able to track delegate access to people's mailboxes. We can also view anything that administrators have done. And this will be a fun one. This will be a long log because this is our demo tenant and a bunch of us are using it. And so you'll see a lot of different activity yesterday and today. I can probably go back. I think it was on 3:31 that I set. No, that's litigation hold. That I set the permissions on Astrid's mailbox and my mailbox. There's been a lot of activity since then. Let's see if that was it. No, probably my best bet because of the amount of activity would be to export and cert at this point, but I was just looking for the record where I'd actually gone in and assigned myself full access to Astrid's mailbox. So this is where you can see any commandlets that have been run against your tenant. And if that happens to have been run by the data center admin, you can see these too. Now, I happen to know that when Asaf was practicing for his demo for the keynote, he actually ran in the data center admin context a mobile device wipe. So other than that, nothing should show up in here. Let's see what we got. There we go. On 3:31 in the morning, we cleared mobile device. So if for any reason your organization has called support and we've had to run some commandlet just to cconfigure, reset config in your organization, you will see it here.
How do you export that out from
that screen? You can print it from this screen. And you can export the admin audit log. That view data center admin audit log is actually part of the overall admin log export. We just have a bit that says this was run by an external party, and that's why it shows up in that bottom report. All right, and let's see. A quick show of SharePoint. Actually, you know what? I've got it open here. I'll just show you quickly since this is the Microsoft Exchange Conference. A number of audit settings that you can configure in SharePoint. This happens to be on a site collection. You'll see edit, check in, check out, a number of other options. You won't see view here until we flight it and enable it in Office 365, but that is coming. All right, so improvements in what we've delivered in the Exchange audit story. Well, today we're limited to 3 million audit entries per mailbox. So if you're doing mailbox auditing or you're doing admin auditing to the arbitration mailbox, you're limited to 3 million items. We've actually scaled that up to 9 billion. And the way that we have done that is by allowing you to separate the audit entries into separate folders, each having 3 million in capacity. And the way that our recoverable item structure works, you can actually have up to 3,000 subfolders. So much bigger scale now. We've also done some work in Office 365 to do noise reduction in the admin audit logs. We used to report on every commandlet that was run in the admin audit logs, but we did a lot of stuff for load balancing and hardware and just making sure that the DEGs were stable and we had things in other geolocations. They were of no interest to any tenants. So we filtered those out, but anything that impacts a tenant or any of the tenant's content, you will see. Also the ops activity reporting, which we've already talked about. Now, finally, as part of what we offer today, I don't think this talk would be complete without just going on over e-discovery, because really when you're doing an investigation scenario or trying to demonstrate compliance within your org, you not only want to find the history of content, but you want to discover the content itself. So the last section, which is right after this slide, is about what we're building to make life easier, so what we're doing in the future, but I'll just touch on this now with e-discovery. As some of you probably know, we've got this e-discovery center in SharePoint where you can discover across your content in both SharePoint and Exchange. And it supports a number of different features that Quentin touched on in, or he went into detail on in his presentation. In the future, we're looking at making org-wide search very, very simple and also integrated with all of our compliance tools. So you can define a bucket of important stuff, whether it's in response to a subpoena or whether it's specific to sensitive content or whether you're investigating someone or a set of specific users. You define your bucket of important stuff and you can take a compliance action as a result of that query, as a result of the result set that you get. So you can choose to put the result set on hold. You can choose to export it. You can destroy it if it's, you know, malicious or inappropriate content. You can just look at it if you're looking for something in particular. And we're working to scale our search such that we will be able to quickly and easily give you estimates, which is those numbers in the top, so you'll know whether your search is, you know, ridiculously huge and you need to hone the data set further. And we'll also give you a quick preview without actually gathering all of the content of the messages. So e-discovery is really morphing into an org-wide search that will give you a really easy, an easy way to define a bucket of important stuff, if you will, and then to operate, use our compliance tools to operate on those. All right. So what are we doing with auditing in the coming months to make life even easier? Well, today our tools are effective, but they're kind of disparate, right? They're in their own sections of the world. Some are in Exchange, some in SharePoint. The retention periods vary. You can't take a look at what this user did in the last 3 days because you have to go out to each of the locations where audit records are stored and try to piece that together. So we've got a vision, and our vision involves 4 things. The first one is to fill in the gaps for events that we log. So we want to include all the events that matter to you, to your regulators, to your compliance officers, and to judges. So we're looking at adding, or we have it in the plan to add calendar and delegate changes as well as SharePoint sharing. So this is when your users are adding permissions to expose your corporate content to more people. Today, we audit permissions changes that are driven by commandlets, but we don't audit when a user shares their folder in their mailbox or shares their calendar or shares a document in SharePoint. So we're adding the user-driven permissions changes to our auditing plan. We're also including all of SharePoint tenant admin activity and Office 365 AD changes that are of interest to your tenant, like user and group, create, read, update, delete, if someone changed a password policy, if someone added a domain to your Office 365 tenant. We're also going to audit OneDrive for Business in the same way we audit SharePoint. So all of the activities, create, read, update, delete, edit, check in, check out, modifications of any kind. And we'll have pivoted reporting. So we're one of the things we're doing is having a centralized storage for all auditing across Office workloads. And from this, we'll be able to index things in such a way that you can take slices that are interesting, like what did this user do? Or tell me all of the history on all my HBI classified content. And also reporting on when content became sensitive. So in general today, anything a user does manually is what we log. When a user goes and touches something, that's when we log. We're going to add when FAST classifies something as sensitive content. The second thing, one simple config to turn on auditing. So in our new unified console, having a place where you just go check a checkbox that says audit Exchange or audit OneDrive for Business. Unified reporting, one reporting console across workloads. And this is going to be made easy as a result of having one central storage location for all of the audit logs. And our goal in doing this is to scale the storage such that you can save things for years and years and years. There's a variety of different scenarios where things have to be persisted for 7 years for some of the financial requirements. We've had lawyers talk about scenarios in which they need the history of all activity on someone's will, and they've had the will for 27 years. So there's a variety of scenarios where we know we need to store it that long, and then subpoenas, you know, can go back many years in requests for data. So we want to get away from a retention period of just a few months where you're exporting the logs and having to maintain them. So we'll give you a sneak peek into unified auditing, which is our new console. It's in its very earliest stages. So you'll see the UI concept, but you won't yet see the simple config concept and the reporting concept. But I'll talk through that. There's about 3 or 4 more slides. And then we'll close it out with Q&A. So let me just flip to... our Compliance Center. So this is an early V1. If I go to auditing, the very first version of this is simply bringing what exists in Exchange and SharePoint today into one place. So this gives you one place to go. Click on some of these links, click on the mail link and click on the SharePoint link, and it'll just take you to the native configuration and the native audit reporting. So the stuff that exists there today. The next step in this will be to have an opt-in or a place to turn on auditing, configure auditing, that will actually get pushed out to workloads. And then the third step is to get our unified storage in place so that we can offer what we call crave-worthy reporting from a single store. So just as a quick example, if I wanted to, let me just choose Teams. In this very early version, this will just jump me to the existing SharePoint experience. So it just makes it a lot easier to navigate, but right now it's just at the navigation level. The next thing that we're planning is here in the top right corner. Like I said, a very simple opt-in that says, look, I just want to audit Exchange, I want to audit SharePoint, OneDrive. You'll see that the admin auditing is grayed out. In our service, we always audit administrative activity, period. So you don't have to think about going and turning that on. You'll want to know what your administrators are doing and what the DT ops people are doing without having to know you have to go in and configure it. So that is on by default for every tenant, every commandlet they've ever run. We have that today. And what this is describing is the way that from that unified console, we are actually going to push that little checkbox out across all of the workloads so that every site collection and every Exchange mailbox and even the Azure Active Directory, the API that we have that we use to call into Azure's AD knows whether or not it has to audit. So I'll go on to this slide because it actually includes the thing in the last slide. How are we going to do this? I mean, there's tons and tons of audit data, and especially in our service when we are responsible for storage costs and the cost to write. How do we expect to do this to scale and to store things for years and years and years? Well, the key, there are two keys. One is to build this in such a way that it scales. So to be able to put it in a storage location that can easily, if it fills up, be chained or be turned over so that it's basically unlimited storage. And the way that we're looking into doing that is actually in an Exchange mailbox. So we're looking at Exchange mailbox chaining as a concept for unlimited archive, and we're going to piggyback on that concept for auditing as well. So basically, you'll write all of your audit records to an Exchange mailbox, and when that fills up, we're aware of the date, time that that contains. We just move on to the next one. And when it comes time to report, we're able to slice across those mailboxes and to report on them. The one bottleneck that concerns us or that we're looking into is that in an enormous tenant, the throughput into a single Exchange mailbox for all your audit logs will be very, very high. And we did the math, and theoretically we'll be okay, but we know that will only be true to an extent. You know, we're talking to companies with 500,000 seats and having every single one of their users write into a single Exchange mailbox store is a limiting factor. In theory, and actually what we've seen in practice, is that you can write 25 items per second into an Exchange mailbox store. And so, of course, that doesn't scale as we scale linearly with mailboxes. So we're also looking at distributing the write, but that will be that will come after we've figured out how to store it, because it's not a critical problem yet. We believe we'll be okay until we get some extremely large tenants in our data center. So the architecture components, we start in our policy store, so where we go configure it. It actually writes to a back-end policy store in Exchange, SharePoint, and as we onboard Yammer and Link, you'll see similar architecture diagrams there. It will write to the policy store, which will push it to the actual location of the content to say, hey, audit, you know, start auditing. Our audit service in each of these workloads will write to what we call the local queue or the uploader. And it keeps it there only temporarily. It will be a matter of minutes. And in all of the workloads that will collect these audit records, we will normalize the schema and write it to the audit upload web service on the Exchange side and eventually to long-term storage in such a way that we can take slices of the data and the schema is well understood so we can easily pivot on things like user across all your workloads. So a few tenets that we've adhered to in designing this is that we want the reports while you wait. So we want them to be returned within 15 seconds. Exchange is good at search. Exchange has some great content indexing. One of the reasons we want to write the audit logs and are working on writing the audit logs to Exchange is because we'll be able to index all those subject lines and the usernames and the file names for those records that come from SharePoint and make them easily searchable. The nature of the audit records is that they're fairly small compared to email items, right? Exchange is optimized for mail items. So they're small and simple, but we can take some of the power of Exchange into account. in our indexing and in the way that we'll need to be able to filter on these. So reports while you wait, 15 seconds to query them. We'd like them within an hour. So this, between the writing, between a user going and actually viewing a doc and having that audit record written and committed to our long-term storage such that it appears in the report, our commitment is an hour or less latency in there. And then we're also committing to, sorry, the light just changed to yellow, which I realize we have about 10 minutes left. Anything manual, including bulk events, will be shown as individual events. So we really want to capture anything the user does. Even if they select 10 messages and they hit delete, it's important because if one of those deletes comes up in a court case, that matters. So if they're system events, we'll capture them as single events. But like an e-discovery query, for example, it's, you know, the lawyer didn't view all 10,000 documents. We don't have to record that. We can just show the e-discovery query and the time that it was issued at. But in terms of actual users operating on content, we'll capture everything. And like I said, with the e-discovery example, system events are captured by the commandlet that enabled them. So this gives us the power to do crave-worthy reporting. And so our goal is to make audit reporting very simple, very clean, and to give you the pivots that you need in order to do the investigations and demonstrate compliance the way that you need to. So you'll be able to pivot on a person, you'll be able to filter on a person, you can see the actions. In this case, you see the target data, so the file name, but we will also include DLP classifications. So you'll be able to filter on sensitive data, you know, just see all the HBI that Sarah Manning touched in the last 2 years, for example. Question?
Sorry, you may have covered this, I missed it, but will we be able to access this via PowerShell as well? Or export it or do?
Yes, there will be commandlet-based tools. Now, these tools will live in a different data center, so they won't be Exchange PowerShell. And this is just under development. It's probably going to be in our Exchange Online Protection data center, just by virtue of the fact that that's part of the compliance team. But we will have PowerShell commandlets for everything we're offering in the UI. All right. So with 7 minutes left, I want to make sure that we've left enough time for questions. So one more pop quiz to end the session, and then I promise I'll leave 5 minutes for questions. Did you come to the right session? So these are spaced that way on purpose because there is a pop quiz within these line items. Oh, Ali left. The product manager had to leave. All right. We have 4 bags of money left, and we have 3 questions within here. So oh, we have 5. Okay. Then I have another question. When you create a tenant in Office 365 and you put data in that tenant, do we own your data?
No.
Right. I heard you. That is correct. We do not own your data. All right. Second one, for those of you who fell asleep but were kind of visual and took note of random things throughout the presentation, I'll do this one as a freebie. You don't have to have learned anything about auditing. What you social insect appeared whenever I referenced the word building? Ant. Correct. All right. So for those of you who want to test whether or not you learned anything about auditing, and for me this is a test of whether I was effective as a speaker at all, audit records help you to do 3 general scenario buckets of things. What is the blank? I heard subpoenas somewhere in this corner. Awesome. Okay. I cannot be held liable for any. No. Nice. All right. And how can we help? Office 365 has taken specific steps to help orgs comply with about 6 regulations. Name one. Yes, we have the HIPAA Business Associate. Yep, there was FEMA, there was FERPA, there was EU Model Clause. Thank you, LCA. All right, and today's solutions, we talked a little bit about what exists in Exchange today and demoed some of the auditing features in the EAC. So finally, what we're building to make it easy in our unified auditing simple config, what type will always be on? All right, I heard somebody, who was it? Oh, did I give you one already?
Behind
you. All right, there you are. Thank you all very much for your time at 6 p.m. on the afternoon after the night before. I appreciate it. Questions? We've got about 4 minutes left. The Unified Compliance Console will work on-prem, but it will first be built for the cloud, so the timeline will be later.
And will it search back through different versions of Exchange, say 2007, 2010, or just strictly for 2013 mailbox?
So it will support hybrid, but as far as going back and searching, we have not decided how far back we are going to support it yet. Everything that impacts the tenant should be. My email is sarah.manning@microsoft.com. If it is not, email me, because that's a bug. You had something?
I was going to ask the differences. You could tell us between Exchange 2010 and Exchange 2013 on where you said you stored this audit log information. I know in 2010.
Yep.
Yes,
so the question was, did we change where we stored it? Not for 2013. What I showed you that's being piped into a single Exchange mailbox for everything is future plans. So that's being built right now. 2013 is still in the same place. We just, we basically architected it in such a way that we could scale to 9 billion events. And that's within the dumpster, or sorry, the recoverable items. Right now, in Office 365, it's just set commands, but we are fixing that. We are going to add search and get. Is that what you're talking about?
No, it's actually new requests, creation of them.
Yeah, we actually exclude move requests because we move mailboxes all the time for load balancing, and audit logs would be 98% move requests.
Incoming inbound move requests from on-prem.
Okay. Oh, okay. Please do email me. So it's sarah.manning@microsoft.com. Anything you're finding that's a surprise in the admin audit logs, email me, because we are committed to fixing that. Those should be complete.
What's the performance hit for turning off audit?
What's the performance hit? So I'm trying to think the best way to answer that. In SharePoint today, our average impact on save, because we enter the save pipeline to record edits and modifies and creates, it's about 6 milliseconds on average, our impact on save. So so it's pretty impressive. Audit events in Exchange, the mailbox auditing, are tens of milliseconds latency from when it happens to when we actually write. And the admins are higher because some of the parameters in the commandlets can be pretty long. So they're in like the 200 to 300 millisecond. Storage, of course, varies on the amount of activity that you have. So we've actually hit, we baseline it, right? We have some requirements. And we're actually doing great. But that's because we shut off SharePoint view auditing and we don't do owner mailbox auditing. So we've been very conservative and we won't introduce these things in the data center until they're performant.
So, yeah. CPU
bit? You know, the way, I can't tell you what percent of the CPU, the way we measure that in it, is its impact, you know, is the latency and its impact on mail flow. And we've had no issues with it so far in the data center. But again, that's because we're limited to delegate and admin auditing.
So it's more of an I/O thing?
It's not an I/O thing yet. It's because the number of events we actually log is not extraordinary. It's average about 7 events per user per day. So that's not extraordinary, but when we re-architect it all to write to a single Exchange server from SharePoint and for admin auditing and everything, that is going to be our biggest bottleneck.
I have a couple questions for you. That's going to be the idea of what an admin is. Because, you know, moving from Exchange 2007, you did all of it totally different, right?
Right. Understood. So I will answer that question up here. I just realized we're out of time. And so I wanted to thank everyone for coming. And I will be at the expo for probably about 20 minutes after this session if you have any further questions. I just don't want to keep you here past 6. I'm sure you're probably all hungry for barbecue. And please, I'll come talk to you about it now because I'm not certain I understand your question. Yeah, just come up and see me. And anyone interested in the answer, please come up and join us.